for changing, starving for truth. Closer to where I started, we're chasing after you. I'm falling even more in love with you. Letting go of all I've ever run to. I'm standing here until you make me.
If it's Thursday, we're doing the Lynch and Kenny thing. So joining me from McAllen, Texas, Tim Lynch. Tim, what's going on?
Not much, Matt. Glad to be here again. Thank you very much.
All right. And from beautiful Southern California, from the great Empire State of Pennsylvania, Jeff Kenny joins us. What's up?
Not much. Enjoying the weather.
Yeah. Actually,
glad to be here, man.
Yeah, actually beautiful, right? So
yeah.
I was having a discussion with somebody today last week, and we were talking about the Commandant's new plan and guidance, and so brought up an interesting subject, and so I thought I'd throw it out there and get your thoughts on it. The pivot to the Pacific and all that. Throughout history, the Marine Corps' utility has been in that it does windows. It's a generalist, although it may lean to one side. So I'm curious to know what you all think. Can the Marine Corps lose its tanks and become this asset tailored for one part of the world and not be the generalist it is, or does it, in attempting to be more useful, does it ultimately become less useful? So, Jeff, your thoughts on that?
I think that it's true. I think that it's a mistake to become so generalist like that, that we lose a lot of our capabilities in case, there's a change in situation elsewhere. Right. And if you have certain pieces of, weaponry that you're going to give up in order to conform to a philosophy of being lighter and everything, being in one theater of the world, then it's very difficult to to retrain folks if you ever have to go back the other way. And so I disagree that we should get that, that focused to where we make unchangeable decisions that affect us.
Explain the nuances of what you're talking about, because explain like the major end items, the supply line that goes with that, the training pipeline. Explain those things to everybody.
Okay, well, let's just take two tanks and tube artillery. I think this is going to, what I'm hearing is we're going to get rid of all tanks and a lot of tube artillery. And I have to tell you, we all of us are all into history and stuff like that. I'll never forget, when I came in the Marine Corps, we had self-propelled 175s, towed 8-inch, we had self-propelled 155s.
Right.
And a year after we got rid of all that stuff, like 2 years after, we did Desert Storm. And we had to double up on 81 millimeter mortar platoons to cover gaps in the fact that they already couldn't keep up with the tanks and the infantry and the AAVs and then for the Army for their mobile vehicles and stuff. So it just was a lesson to me that if you had a more robust enemy, it could have really been it could have really cost us. It could even be, could cause a tactical defeat. And so I think the idea of getting rid of tanks, and again, that tube artillery, it's cheap, relatively speaking, to like rockets and stuff like that. And, it's an art form. It's an art form that you lose. It's damn hard to get it back again. Both as far as the tank, both the tactics and the mechanics, the logistics systems, the tool and die that makes the things work, right. All that stuff just goes away, and it's very difficult to bring it back.
Right. Tim, your thoughts on it?
it seems to me that if you get rid of the MAGTAP, the Marine Air Ground Task Force, that you leave yourself open to becoming the British, the Royal Marines.
What does that mean?
That means that you are a very small, a granted elite force that's primarily based off of naval shipping that can be used ashore in a pinch, but is highly trained basically to work off the water, doing maritime interdiction work and those kind of things. In a pinch, as in the Falklands or in Iraq, they form very effective infantry, but they're not fighting above the regimental level. Matter of fact, they are not fighting at the regimental level because their regimental system, those are actually battalion-sized formations by the time they get them out into the field. So if you want a Marine Corps that's a few thousand guys that are you know, the top-notch naval commandos, that's fine. I don't think that America needs that, quite frankly. I think the value of the Marine Corps has been in the combined air ground task force, which quite frankly has performed time and time again. It outperformed anybody in the theater. I'm talking Grenada. I'm talking in Panama. We've demonstrated time and time again going into the Helmand. That when you deploy the entire logistical package with its own aircraft, everything under one commander, we're more efficient with a smaller number of people. And it's just a fact. But it's not a fact you can go to Congress and say, hey, you've got to leave our force structure alone because we're better than everybody else. That's not an argument that you're going to win, but it's a fact.
Do you think Congress will buy it? So the next thing is, can the country afford it? Because there's only, the country has finite resources, and to buy whatever it puts in its basket to defend the nation. Can the country afford such a tailored force given the scarcity of divisions and, you know, without, if the Marine Corps decides that we're going to be over here and we're going to be so nuanced as at the macro level, where the Senate Armed Service Committee and the House Armed Service Committee live, and you're looking at, okay, we've already said we're going to stand down from being able to fight two wars simultaneously. Now we're going to have one of our Swiss Army knives become a single blade event. Can the nation afford it, Jeff?
I'll tell you, I think we can't. And here's the thing. Going this way doesn't mean we're going to be spending less money. I mean, this F-35 and the new 53
kilo.
Those are $100 million per copy.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's ridiculous, man. And you know, the thing about it is, what always keeps you, you know, grounded should be, how am I in relation to the enemy? And we're like gobs and gobs ahead of anybody else. But we keep going for this stuff. You know, it becomes a moral imperative that we have the F-35. You know, it becomes a moral imperative, you know, that we, you know, it's just, and so we're spending ourselves into ineffectiveness. We're going to be tailored towards our air wing. We're going to be tailored towards technology. And the truth of it is, so many times the type of conflicts we get in, our enemies see that we have a technological advantage, so that it's shaped in such a way that it's negated. I mean, what good really is an F-35 going to do us when we're slugging it out in Ramadi and Fallujah? And basically, the enemy only becomes clear to us when he manifests himself by shooting at us. I mean, you know what I'm saying? They go low tech to deal with us. That's where the blood happens. And so to do away with, you know, your muscle, do away with some of those nuts and bolts things in favor of high-tech wizardry, you know, it's just not prudent.
Do you think Congress would allow, I'm trying to think of when you look at conflict around the world, you say, okay, who's playing? Well, the whole Marine Corps can play, right?
Yeah.
So when you turn and you fight tanks and you're not trying to seize, you know, comm relay stations and choke points along waterways, but all of a sudden the war happens someplace else. And now you say, okay, Marine Corps, let's go. And if the Marine Corps says, yeah, we're not so good at that anymore. Do you remember? Like, we don't have any tanks. What? You know, and that is three divisions of your combat power. Do you think that Congress will allow that, the Marine Corps, to get that specialized and towards one fight?
I mean, I really don't know. Right. I mean, I'm not, I know, I just, most of the stuff I know about how that stuff works, I get from friends of ours who've been in that job, right. Like John Furness and John Kennedy. And so it's not an altruistic thing where they have their opinion and then we have ours. It's more of a huckster type. It's a deal making thing where all kind of things are in play, from factories and congressional districts, you know, and that has a lot to do with it. So I really don't know, Mac, about that. I know there's a lot of money that is generated by taxpayers that's wasted on a lot of dumb stuff, right. And a lot of it is wasted on military dumb stuff. But I don't know if that's really the issue. You know, the fact that Congress won't stand for it. Well, I'm wondering if we're limiting ourselves. You know,
not that they won't stand for it, but there's not the money for us to be that nuanced. Because if we're that nuanced, then does the Army have to be expanded to cover that capability in this crisis? Or Timmy?
And that is a very good point. It used to be back in the Carter days, I seem to remember, or Reagan days, it used to be the Marine Corps made a big deal out of pointing out that we're only 7% of the defense budget, but we're 40-something percent of the ground forces, which, as you've been dealing with accounting, it's in the books, because Navy provides all of our air, all of our medical, all of our chaplain services. So that's actually cooking the books. It's true, but not really that true. But what I would maintain is what we cannot afford is a large standing army and a large standing naval infantry force, for specifically the reasons that Jeff has articulated, in that our acquisitions, I mean, we couldn't win the Civil War with the acquisition process we have now. You would have never got the monitor. It wouldn't have happened. So we've become so expensive that I think what the Marine Corps ought to be doing is emphasizing that we're the low-tech guys who can still go into areas and flow in with significant enough manpower to make a difference within a constrained area. Because most of the time we're using amphibious ships and we're not landing against defended beachheads. Most of the time we're going into typhoon places and hurricane places and things like that. Or we're doing what we did with Iraq in the March Up, which is just using that as a little bit of an amphibious feint.
Yes,
so I think we should be going big, and I think we should maintain the Marine Air Ground Task Force, because it's a bottom line cost per dollar of deploying that combined task force together, rather than reaching into commands from the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy. That's cost effective. And I think what we should be saying is we're cost effective. 40% of your manpower on boots on the ground, 7% of your defense budget. Come on. We're the guys that we should somehow facilitate them to put their hungry gaze elsewhere, because there's a lot of places to cut.
Yeah.
And I don't think the Marine Corps has much of it.
What Tim says about the effectiveness of the MAGCOM, it's one of the few non-bullshit advertisements we do.
Well, hold on. I'm not even going to play devil's advocate, but let me just put the Marine Corps is still going to say, oh, we're still MAGTAP.
Yeah,
we're still going to be organized around the triumvirate of aviation, ground, and logistics. We'll always be the MAGTAP. It's just not going to be your grandma's MAGTAP, if she was that kind of girl.
Yeah, they'll say that.
Yeah, but you've got like the 18th Airborne Corps, who says they're the nation's force in readiness, ready to go, right?
Right.
And we launched them in Grenada. We launched them into Panama.
And Haiti.
That did not work out well at all.
No.
I mean,
no.
So.
Wait, hold on. Explain why it didn't work out well at all.
Oh, okay. In Grenada, they were assigned to take the airport, to jump into the airport, clear the airport, and then they had a coordination line about half of the island that they're going to coordinate with the Marines. They jumped in too low. It took, I think, something like 20% casualties, you know, broken backs, broken legs. There's a bunch of Cuban construction workers there who happened to have some Browning machine guns, and they were lighting them up. And as the days progressed in Grenada, the area of operations for the Marines expanded through the entire island, and everything with the Army was just restricted to that. They never broke out of that. I mean, until the Marines came in and came in behind them with Amtraks. And the same with the SEALs. They were tasked to rescue the British ambassador, whoever, Sir Paul Scoyne was his name.
Yes.
And
yeah,
they said that they got... Yeah, and they said, hey, we're trapped. They got us pinned down. We're under fire. And we lost two Cobras flying to defend those guys. Then the Marines... Then E'Toole Smith lands his friggin' track platoon, and they climb on up to St. George there, and everybody flees. They knock on the door. Sir Paul Scoyne and the SEALs come out. And they climb back down into the water, and off they go.
Well, hey, do you remember the great quote, supposedly attributed to some army?
Like,
God damn it, right? There's two regiments of soldiers down there sitting in the southern half, the southern two-thirds of the island, or the southern third of the island, and the Marine Corps is romping around the whole rest of it. What the hell is going on down there?
With two companies, because they had a company on board ship to react. Yeah, it was amazing. And then in Panama, which we were steaming at flank rate for, and then got written out of the program in 1990, which made me bitter to Colin Powell starting right then. They jumped into mud flats. I think the Panamanians had to organize a pretty robust rescue system to get them out of the mud before the tide came in. They just were not effective. My point was always, since IOC, when I used to talk about parachutists. After 3 days, they're refugees. You know, you can only take so much out of those planes with you. And I've done it. I mean, Jeff's done it. It's not fun. But you get on the ground.
You're 9 minutes away from exhaustion when you jump in.
Yeah. I mean, within 3 days, unless you've got reinforcements, you're a refugee. You know, you're now one of the people screaming, looking for food and water. So I don't buy it. I don't buy that airborne thing. I think jumping out of planes is a military deployment, unless you're talking Halo and high speed stuff. I'm not so sure it's that viable.
Do you remember the picture of somebody had jumped into Iraq, and into northern Iraq, and they had just the biggest pack you've ever seen on their back. And there's a picture of the guy in the knee, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's used oftentimes when, you know, this whole concept of take a knee. But this guy's got the biggest pack you've ever seen. And you're like, okay, where the hell are you guys going with that much weight on? And then to include, you know, the sappy plates you wear now and all the rest of that shit. So,
Timmy makes a great point there. Those are two good thumbnail sketches of both Grenada and Panama. But I have to say, If we like tailor ourselves to be this kind of light in the ass force tailored for, you know, for whatever we think our engine of entry is going to be, then sure as dollars to donuts, we'll have an enemy that realizes that. I mean, the Chinese seem to they're deep in our stuff. They're about stealing our intellectual property and all this stuff. They'll tailor themselves for, hey, the Marines don't have any weight in their ass. You don't have to worry about them. You know, yeah. And the Army can't get there. So I think what will happen is there'll be conflicts maybe all over the world where a piece of real estate is seized, and they know that it'll take us months to be able to react because we just don't have it anymore. You know, I mean, people act like when they make these decisions about how we're going to be that it's like no one's going to know. You don't think the enemy's going to watch? I mean, they're watching all this stuff we're doing constantly. And so you want to make sure that you're going to have to fight another slugfest like Korea, then get rid of your stuff. And you will. And then you won't have the ass to do it.
Right.
You know, I really believe that's a lesson of history.
But historically, our forces have always been generalist in nature and then nuanced for whatever fight we go to. And that, and then over time, as we've seen that, you know, the Marine Corps and the Army, you know, are different organizations, but they can just about go anywhere and go and do anything. I mean, they're pretty versatile tools when everybody goes and fights wherever we go. But, you know, the more you read about, you know, what the Marine Corps will become, you know, then the question is, well, you're not a Swiss Army knife anymore because, you know, you don't do windows, right? Or you only do one kind of window. And I just don't know. I don't know that the nation can afford that. Even if it's like, yeah, you know, well, why wouldn't, okay, then you could tailor the 3rd Marine Division to be like that. That's all right. Right, and when you go out to become part of 3rd Division, you know, you put on your 3rd Marine Division costume, and you're a fight tonight guy out in 3rd Mar Div. But the whole Marine Corps can't be like, you still have to have the thunderous right hook that exists out in the desert, and you know, you still ought to have the European piece that is developed and exists in the 2nd Marine Division. I don't know. So I it's an interesting discussion with all the nuances that you guys are bringing out involved in it. And so I think it's like okay, this is really cool, and we're going to pivot to the Pacific. Well, what happens if you don't fight in the Pacific? What happens if they fight someplace else?
They've been saying that all ever since Beirut. We got to get back in the amphibious business. We got to focus on the Pacific. They've been saying that. They said it after Desert Storm too. And history just won't let you. No, the bad stuff's happening from here, you know. And no matter what, how much they want to do that, it's just, you know, the emergencies pop up and we're challenged in different theaters. Now, maybe we will get challenged in the Pacific, but making yourself less capable to win a fight is not prudent.
And also, what differentiated the Marine Corps performance in Panama and Grenada was mobility. You know, we had LAVs, we had Amtraks, we had, I don't think tanks were used in either place, but that's, you can't just fly that craft in and jump it out of an airplane. I think that credible presence on a ship, and because a battalion landing team can chew some people up. That's not an inconsiderable amount of combat power that's loitering about on either side of the ocean, either side, ends of the earth in general, with our 2 mu rotations. That's not inconsiderable, and I think giving that up would be a horrible mistake.
Yeah.
The other thing that was interesting about the discussion is that, you know, I've seen articles written that said the Marine Corps will give up this to get this. The Marine Corps will drop in strength in order to modernize this. Well, I don't, unless somebody's going to guarantee you that money that gets spent in this pipeline over here through the Pentagon, we're going to allow you to dry that up and then put it in this pipeline, those are completely different. Like, it doesn't work like that, right?
No.
It doesn't work like that.
No.
And so I looked at that, I read that, I was like, okay, right, if you believe that, you're as dumb as the people that said, oh, yeah, we believe that the Congress is going to replenish all these military construction things after the president's taken the money and spent it down on the border. Like, look, I don't know if you pay attention to Congress, but half of one of the houses is controlled by the Democrats. And trust me, they ain't going there. Like, oh, sure, no problem. We'll replenish all that. You won't feel any ass pain for what you did. Oh, no, you're going to feel it. You want to go there? Go there. And then you're going to hear it from your military that you raided that shit. And so I just, when I read that, yeah, that we'll be able to take it from manpower and then put it into this, I thought, yeah, I don't know who's telling you that. But if you don't have it in writing with everybody's, you know, slapping the table in public on camera, then you're a fool if you do that. They'll say, oh, yeah, that manpower, we'll just add it to the Army. And put in your wish list, we'll get to that when we can. But, yeah, you can go down to whatever you want to. No problem. I don't know.
It starts at the strategic level. If you accept the notion that America is a maritime power, that all of our power is based on maritime force projections, you can make the argument that you don't need a large standing army. Mexico and Canada are not a threat to us. But who makes that argument? It can't be the Commandant of the Marine Corps. I don't think you're going to hear too many Navy officers saying that. I mean, how do you construct that argument? Because if you proceed from the fact that we're a maritime power and that's how we project our force, then we should be organizing ourselves differently. And Major Allen, General Allen, pointed this out to us when we were captains. I remember him saying this. Every 4 years they have this quadrennial defense review, and all they do is evenly slice off the tops of who's getting what. The Air Force still gets 33%, the Army gets 35%, the Navy gets the rest, and Marine Corps gets 7%. It doesn't matter what we say, they always slice horizontally across the top or increase in increments as appropriate, and that's not a defense review. That's just rice bowl guarding, and right now we're rice bowl guarding.
And something else, too. We have a lobby group within our own service. I don't know if that's at odds sometimes with the Marine Corps' ethos, and that's the Marine Air Wing. I mean, they're not on the same page. They have different priorities. They have different things they think are important. I mean, it's hard to do an exercise a lot of times because of that. To make use of the philosophy that Tim brought up about the MAGTAF. That's not just a temporary thing. That's always been a problem. Ask Tim's dad about the Commandant scandal in the early 70s, you know, with the assistant Commandant trying to rig the way who voted. I remember your dad telling us about that, Tim, you know. And then it's just been a constant theme where they're, like, kind of at odds with us, sometimes in dangerous ways, I think.
Yeah, sustain aviation at all costs. And if our vision doesn't line up with yours, that's all right. We're into aviation, not into the Marine Corps. Right?
Yeah, I mean, General Anderson. With one exception, that's when they're inside of a MU or a MEB or something like that, and they've got one guy in charge. And as you know, with a MU, it's one time it's an infantry guy, the next time it's an air guy. But when that squadron belongs to that MU, the MU's priority becomes its priority. That's the only time you see it different.
That was a 3 for the 15th MU. It was hard to deal with those guys. Hard to deal with.
Wow. You just ruined my bubble. There's my ideal vision ruined by experience.
Yeah. You know, not all the time, but, you know, and we worked them hard. I mean, they did the tsunami, and then we went into Iraq. When we went into Iraq, we lost them, but not really. You know what I mean? They all joined up with the big glop of Marine Air that was controlled by the met forward in there, you know.
Right.
But we still, when we needed air, we usually got them.
Right.
But it was not easy. They were the hardest bunch to deal with. Easiest one was Lieutenant Colonel Furness and his Howling Commandos of 1-1.
No, I mean, I remember 2004 when the MU, you know, when the MUs would chop. You know, I don't know where the nickname came from, but they were known as the Imperial MUs, right? They would come ashore, dun da da dun, right? And everybody, like the division, the map, you know, like you guys are the MU, and that's important to you, but nobody else gives a shit. And everybody else looks like, oh, you guys are here? What are you going to do? Well, we're going to the Triangle of Death. Like, well, where's that? Oh, Ron Johnson just made, his PAO just made it up. Like, well, what are you guys doing? Oh, we're doing the same coordinate search shit that we did yesterday, but we just gave it a name, and now it's on CNN all over the place.
Yeah, that's the guys we went in after.
Right. That's a no-shit story. Like, hey, call them up. What's going on? Where the fuck's the Triangle of Death?
Oh, well, let me just caveat what I said. Tim, you're right. It works best on the MU, but it still sucks there. You know, it just sucks less on the MU. You know, I mean, because I hear from my friends, one of them is a general we both know, and it ain't any. It's very difficult dealing with with our air guys. And they probably say the same thing about us, but they're wrong. We're right, you know. Jeff, us being grunts.
Yeah, you know? Jeff is right. They have their own thing going on, and sometimes they don't like to play. Any evolving thoughts on Syria?
I still think it's too early. I don't know who's killing who and who's doing what. I still think that Trump made the right decision. At some point, we've got to start backing away from some of these commitments. And Turkey was going to go. It's a strip of land that they're going to contest. And I'm telling you, they're going to get their butts handed to them. I mean, it's not going to be an easy fight for Turkey. And they've already lost a bunch of tanks in the months leading up to this move. So I'm exactly where I was last week. Although, admittedly, Trump's handling of this with the press and whatnot, not the most deft movements by him. But I don't care. I think the instincts are right.
Yeah, it's very – everything's connected with the – impeachment stuff, and you know, I mean, when he does this, although he doesn't let that really seem to be connected. I mean, he gave these guys a chance. Tell me why this is a good idea to have these guys in here, and it just didn't meet the smell test to him. It's like, we don't like Assad, and we, you know, so why are we protecting the Syrians from the, you know, from the Turks? And what do we really care about? I mean, the Kurds, people say, well, we're abandoning them if they fought our war. No, they fought their own war, because the Kurds are going to get savaged by ISIS. I mean, look what happened to the Yazidis. You know, they're like half-assed Turks anyway, you know, or Kurds anyway. And I mean, it was just awful. So it's like, you know, I think they'll come to it. And I have to tell you, I looked at some of these, I mean, just anecdotally, looking at the equipment that they have, they got some pretty snazzy MRAPs. They didn't grow out of the garden in the Kurd forest, you know. I mean, somebody gave them stuff. Some of them were given a lot of stuff. And I think that somebody might be known as Yungala Sam, as my grandmother would say. The Italians would say Yungala, meaning your uncle. But Yungala Sam has been generous to all those folks in there, you know, that are kind of on our side. And so if they can't handle this thing now, I mean, after all these years, all this money, you know, and stuff put in there, me, Mr. Advisor guy, I'm sick of it, you know, because it bespeaks of a dishonesty, you know, like you're being manipulated by these guys. Because they know there's more things at stake, and there's more factors that affect American decisions than just what's going on over there and what, you know, agreements that are made. Press is huge. The way it looks in the press is huge. It always has been. But I think Trump says, look, I'm going to give you so much time. I'm going to come back if things better or worse. If they're not going the right way, you're done.
Yeah, I still disagree with both of you. I'm not going to roll the Mattis audio, right? Because I'm not that kind of a guy to do that. But I think it's a bad decision, and then I think his execution of the decision was even worse. When the dysfunction that's on the east side of the Potomac, you know, it spreads to the Pentagon, and you hear words like blindsided. You know, to me, if that's what he wants to do, there's a way to execute that. There's a way to coordinate it with and make deals to the best we can to guarantee the status quo. But I mean, the way that we rolled out of there, when you have military people saying this is fucking bullshit, right? This is what we're doing to the force that we developed, and that there's no way that we could mitigate this, saying that we're going to get out of here in 6 months, right? And to make deals now we have the Russians in there and the Syrians in there. And so I think, Tim, I absolutely agree with you. The optics of it, I mean, are horrible. Horrible. Well, so, anyway.
The optics of everything is horrible.
There's another dynamic here, which is the news reports. And I just wanted to point out with this thing with ABC News, where they showed this footage from a range and said this is Syrians being slaughtered. And I saw that and I was thinking, if only we had cell phone video of those FPS we used to do down in Quantico, we could be selling that stuff to news services, showing all the.
You can find
it. It's ridiculous, the kind of stuff that we're getting out of the media.
You can find it. You can find it if you went looking.
Yeah, and but the other thing is, so now you've got the Syrians up there fighting the Turks. The Syrians are supported by the Russians. The Russians need the Turks to get out of the Black Sea and into the Mediterranean. This is beautiful because there's a lot of problems being created there, and not one of them is ours. Not one.
Right. Let me pose something to you guys, and bear with me. I mean, I was never – there's nothing President Obama did almost that I agreed with. Certainly not pulling us out of Iraq in 2011 the way he did, which it seems like there's consensus that's what led to ISIS rolling in there and everything. But look at it this way. So what? So ISIS rolled in there. What is that to us, really? I mean, ISIS isn't going to stay in there. I mean, if they do, who cares? Then they got Iraq. I mean, what is that to us? I mean, what is the bad problem that could come from that? From fighting going on in a place we were, but we're not anymore, and we really don't have a dog in the fight. What good does it do us to be in there? What good does it do us to have guys in there keeping the Kurds and the Turks and the Syrians from fighting? What good does that do us?
Well, I mean, if you look at what happened, I mean, they had overrun,
yeah,
you know, much of Al Anbar, and so
yeah, because Al Anbar is Sunni, and the ISIS is Sunni, and the job we did setting up the Iraqi army, even though gobs of money were spent and all kind of stuff and all kind of, you know, different types of things were invested in them, they fell on their ass, and so.
I know, but where you're content by saying fuck it, that's their problem, walk away. Most of the rest of the leadership of the government isn't okay with that.
Well, I mean, President Obama was.
Well, there you go.
And but I'm just saying what
I rarely identify you and he together though, so I'm struggling with that.
Well, I'm just saying he thought this. I don't think it's worth anybody else getting killed because it'll hurt me in my, you know,
yeah,
my re-election here next year. So, I mean, that's probably why he did it. But
yeah,
I'm just saying.
And I don't think Trump's any different. I think Trump's doing it because he made a campaign promise, and he's checking those things off. So when he runs for re-election, he's going to stand up and say, I told you I would do this, and I did this. I've delivered on this. I've delivered on this. I've delivered on this. And any of the repercussions that come out of that, I don't think he gives a shit, to be honest with you.
Right. And what could the repercussions be?
Well, I guess we'll find out.
Well, I mean, well, what's the worst that could happen? Let me put it that way.
I think the worst is that you allow chaos to expand. You know, chaos being the lack of any viable government entity far enough into the Middle East, it would destabilize the world. It would generate so much economic instability that it would ruin us all. I believe would be the globalist view of this, because I'm perfectly content to let them fight. I think it was Bill Lind who said about that. Why can't they both win? What do we care? But I'm with you on that, Jeff. But there's a certain amount of chaos, of instability that I don't think you can tolerate. And I think that was one of those areas where we're a little bit more sensitive.
Well, I think that it would be a couple of things. One, ultimately, does this hand Syria to Iran? And now we've further withdrawn.
That ship has sailed.
Out of the region. And then, so that's two. And I know Jeff will dismiss this, but the humanitarian crisis that's going to ensue because of this. So if you're okay with both of those things, if you can wipe those away, then I guess you're okay. But the question is, when it then spreads back, when, you know, and the reading that I've done said, look, then ISIS is gonna become fully functional again. They're gonna seek to move into Western Iraq again. And then are you gonna go back again? Or are you gonna say fuck that too?
That's something we can win. But here's it might be that somebody decides, you know, that we have interests that necessitate that. But I have to tell you this: if you don't have the military, especially our military, doing something with clearly defined objectives, it's going to become a horrible fuck story. And I mean, you of all people, you identified what happened in Iraq, and then the same thing in Afghanistan. It's an open-ended bullshit story that never ends. And now these guys are, what are they trying to do in Syria, really? What is the goal? Is the goal to make sure that
So let's talk about that. So what do you do? So intellectually, what do you do? Whether you talk about Vietnam, you've unleashed this beast in this part of the world. You've unleashed this symphony of death in this part of the world. They were nicking each other, right, back and forth. But you took the whole thing, and you know, you put it on a scale that nobody could even imagine. And now you've decided, yeah, fuck, this is not going to work out like old Bob McNamara thought it would. He and that slick hairstyle probably aren't like what we thought it was. Holy shit. Now what do? We just unass this motherfucker and go home? What do you do when you find yourself in stride and you've concluded, you know, that this is not going to be what we want it to be and we want to go home?
Yeah, we should win like we didn't do in Iraq. We could have. I mean, they not only was it a bad idea to go in there, like you said, but it was poorly executed. And then it wasn't finished. And then we pulled out. And so that was probably a bad decision. But the bad decisions multiplied. And there was no good decisions. Now they'll say, well, the surge was a great stroke of genius. No, it wasn't. I mean, every E3 and any service could tell you we needed more people over there just to hold our own. But if they had done some things like that in the beginning,
right,
we would have won. But our people won't win, Mac, anymore. They won't win. General Mattis, all those guys, they will
okay,
not
okay,
win.
Okay, now, so, okay, 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 so, I'll, so, okay, so we come to that point sitting around the table.
Yeah.
Right? I'm the president. I'm looking at you guys. Tim's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. You're the Secretary of Defense, right? Jeff, your dog is the Secretary of State. And everybody says the same thing. Okay, so what moral obligation do we have to a nation that we invaded and we've unleashed this beast in?
Mm-hmm.
What do we have any moral obligation to that?
So you're talking about Iraq now, right?
Well, I mean, we've done the same thing in Afghanistan, right?
Yeah, right. Okay, Iraq or Afghanistan?
Iraq, Afghanistan, pick one.
Well, let's do historical, precedents. What other two nations have ever been showered with such largesse, not to mention a total of almost 7,500 dead American? What other nation
Vietnam?
In recent memory has had that and still been able to fucking do their own thing? Even though they outnumber the enemy, even though they outgun the enemy, even though they get paid better, they have better medical, everything. On their own, they get their ass kicked. How much is enough then? Should it go on forever?
Okay. No. Okay, so I look at you, because I'm the president, and I say, okay, are you the SecDef or the chairman? You're the SecDef. Okay. Okay, SecDef, I got it. How do we get out of this? So we to quote Richard Nixon, peace with honor. So
right.
How do we set this up so that we can exit? Give me a timeline. Tell me what we do, and how do we unass this thing with knowing that this is our fault? They had the thing organized. They had
well,
had
it's not our fault. What are you talking about?
Well, no. Let me tell you. When we attempted to fashion something that had never existed in history, right? And then we said, yeah, we'll get the forces. They had the nation, right, tied up in their own way, through their own conflicts. They had this.
Saddam had it tied up.
Saddam and Afghanistan had their own little, you know, right, city-states.
Yeah.
Everybody, it was all cobbled together in some way, shape, or form. The Americans come, and we wave our magic wand, and we say, no, we shall recast this thing as a federal republic. Right?
Yeah, you're absolutely preaching to the choir.
Okay, so my question is, Mr. Secretary, how would we unass that thing if we came to this decision? Let's say we come to this decision, and we'll just use Iraq in 2009, right? We come to this decision in 2009, And we're sitting there, right? There is no ISIS thing. And we say, okay, let's, how do we wind this thing down, right, on a scale that allows them to stand up and allows us to feel like we did right by these people? What do we do, and what does that look like? And do we leave a residual force in the country someplace? How would you do it? What would you recommend?
I don't agree with the first tenets.
What?
Here's the thing. 2009.
Wait. What's the first tenet?
Well, you're saying since we did this to them, now we what? How can we set the stage so that it lasts?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I wouldn't use the word last. So that we can give them, right, we can give them at least a legitimate chance to sustain this thing.
Oh,
and that's how I want to, I'm not going to guarantee it. What?
That's my whole thing, was always trying to give them a chance to stand on their own. And I watched it, you know, from 2005.
I know, no, I don't want to talk about that. I want you to advise me, as the Secretary of Defense, on how you would get us out of that.
It's done. They got to do it now. They got more weaponry than any of the countries in Europe that we've been protecting from the, you know, from the mythical Soviet Union before it fell. They got more of everything.
Okay, so you just tell me they got more of everything. We should leave.
Yeah, we give them a time, and in 18 months we're gone.
All right.
Be ready.
All right.
Dig trenches in Syria or whatever, but on the Syrian border. But we're going,
Tim.
Because it's been 6 years.
Got it. Okay, I got it.
6 years.
I got it. Tim, you're sitting at the table. You got to vote. How do you wind something like this down once you conclude? And do we have any obligation to them,
gentlemen? The issue here is the prestige of the United States of America. This is not about our petty political ambitions. Obviously, the course forward is clear. We need to go and kill a bunch of them and then pull out all of a sudden and say that we won. I do believe that is essentially what we always do. We'll ramp up our military posture, thump the hell out of them, say, okay, there you go. That's the last of it, and off we go. I do believe that's more or less what we have traditionally done.
Yeah, I agree with you, Timmy. And you know something, Mac? It's not that we can't do this.
Hold on. Can't do what?
Can't win these things, like Timmy's saying. We just won't. Like that thing you talk about, you're absolutely right. You describe what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. But initially, Afghanistan was pretty much a success. They went in there with a light enough touch. Everything was going fine. But then careerism crept in. We got to put battalions in there. Because, like you said, we got to turn this thing into Jeffersonian democracy, as General Zinni would say. And we got to make them learn how to treat women right. We got to make sure that everybody's voting and using purple dye in their fingers. We got to do all that stuff. Whereas when we first went in there, in the first couple years we were there, that's not how it was. And it was working pretty good. We basically grew the insurgency in those different provinces in Afghanistan by sticking a bunch of National Guard units and, you know, and army outfits and stuff like that, owning battle space, the ridiculous concept that only exists, you know, in the U.S., brain trust there, and caused this thing to become what it is now. You're right. And now the only, and rubbing that rash, is this going to make it worse?
So once you get to a point where you say, well, and so I want you, Jeff, to legitimately address this concept of American prestige around the world. If you look at that and say, hey, this is a fucking mistake, we're out of here. Is that, because Timmy brought up, and I don't think that's a non-issue. I think it is an issue that we're not like everybody else, and we tend to do things that most nations wouldn't undertake. And so how do you, and again, knowing that we fucking did it, all that instability in Iraq and Syria gets laid at the plantation.
How is Syria our lookout? It is, but I'm just asking.
ISIS?
Yeah, I mean, how did
Syria? No, the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring started all that, and we started the Arab Spring.
Yeah, right. Because we're in. Why do we do that? What good did that do? What good did setting the stage to overthrow Gaddafi do? Except flood Europe with all kinds of refugees. We have been messing around with shit, and we're not good at it.
No.
It causes things to be worse.
Hey, hold on. First of all, saying we're not good at it is an insult to everybody that's not good at something. We suck. It's like anytime you as an American think about using force, don't do it. Because, right, you fuck it up every time.
Wrong. That's not what I'm saying. We didn't go into Iraq to make Iraq like, Iowa. But that's what it became. It morphed. Mission creeped into that. Because a lot of people, looked at that and saw opportunity.
Well, hold on. Well, and this is the beauty of this discussion. We went into Iraq, and it's, now it's painful to read, but Phase 4 wasn't even defined in either Iraq or Afghanistan. And to think that Tommy Franks, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, did not...
Was he? Or he was CENTCOM, though.
He was CENTCOM. Right. That he didn't say, hey, stop, man. Somebody's got to define for me what this thing looks like and then how we're going to get the fuck out of it, or else I'm not going to put my name on this for history. Because this is not how we've ever envisioned it. And so, so to me, that's a crisis at the general officer level. Okay? That is, if we don't have general officers that will do the most basic shit like that, then,
I've got a question here, because we beat on the generals a lot, and you're asking what would you do when all of a sudden you realize it's time to get out. What would you think of a president that went in front of the UN and said, here's what we went in to accomplish, this is clearly not working, we're going to need to extricate ourselves, and here's our plan for getting out, and basically says, look, this was our intentions, it's not possible for those intentions to be made. We've done our best. Go Menisai. That's Japanese for I'm sorry. And just try to pull out of there without getting massacred.
Sounds
on the
like
way
Ronald
out
Reagan
by angry locals. I wonder if anybody would even think that were possible.
Sounds like Ronald Reagan, 1984, pulling us out of Beirut, Tim.
Because
the Jews, he's like thinking, are we going to go in there with 100,000 guys and make Lebanon like Ohio,
No, it's frustrating. But Tim, I think when you look at like America's, prestige around the world, and we have that discussion, and what is the impact of these things on that, and you might call it a dance, a bullshit dance, a charade, but to me, going to the UN and saying, hey, look, here's what we believe will happen, right?
Why would you go to the UN about anything?
Because you're playing charades. All right, I'm now the president of the United States. Okay, so I'm a politician. Okay, you fucking monkeys fucked it up, and now you fuckers are telling me we can't make this thing. We told you we could do it. It's all fucked up. None of us here did it because it was the guys before us all that are stupid. Okay, we're just left with it. Okay, so that's the truth. Okay, I'm going to go to the UN and I'm going to tell them. Here's the truth. The truth is, we thought that we could do this. We've tried. It's failed. We're coming to grips with that. I need a UN force that will get between these two bodies when we leave, or there will be a humanitarian crisis that we believe will be between this the left limit and the right limit. And I'm here today with my hat in my hand.
That's happened, and usually it's a disaster.
Well, but... You're walking the dog, you know what I'm saying? And then you look at the American people and say, we've tried to the Iraqi people, we've given you everything we can. I don't know, I don't want to say the words peace with honor, because I just fucking hate that. But what do you do, when you're in stride, you've done an in-stride fuck-up? And
It's impossible to say, because that somebody coming up and honestly ahead of the nation, honestly coming out and laying that out, it would never happen. And probably experts in diplomatic relations would be able to explain to you exactly why it shouldn't happen, for all I know. But how refreshing would it be to hear somebody tell you the damn truth about this stuff?
I
love Afghanistan. I love the Afghans. I loved it over there, but they're screwed, and there's nothing I can do for them. But how would you like to hear that at the national level? Somebody just tell you the truth.
That'd be crazy.
And I think if we left, Iraq would be okay. Would stand on its own. It'd be rough, but they would stand there, I think, Afghanistan. Their own corruption, even though I got a lot of experience with Afghans, too.
Yep.
Their own corruption, the weirdness of, the ethnic rivalries and stuff like that, not to mention the interference of Pakistan and, to a certain extent, India and other countries. I just don't think they even give a shit. I think most of your average Afghan doesn't even think about Afghanistan. That's a big joke, you know. But the Iraqis, they might have a shot. They certainly both have enough hardware and money, and more than their enemies. They outnumber their enemies. It's ridiculous. I mean, you get sick of saying it. And yet everybody just kind of goes, well, you know, they just can't do it. They just won't do it. Let me tell you, talk to some of these Afghan officers. The guys say, yeah, I gotta go and leave. So where are you going? What part of Afghanistan are you going to? Oh, I got a house in Dubai. Really? I don't have a house in Dubai.
Right.
Yeah, that's their go-to place. So it's like, you know, to me, it's those guys who died trying to help them, and then us saying that, well, you know, how would this look? You know, if we leave now, you know, fuck it, man. It always looks like shit.
Yeah, you're not a politician, though. Fuck it doesn't work.
And neither is a president.
Well, I know, but I mean, we say fuck it, and then we went back there. When, you know, all of a sudden there's this humanitarian outrage. There's now that ISIS exists, and it's totally fucked up, and who goes back there? The United States goes back there, right? And as was predicted. So the question is, will we go back there again in 5 years when ISIS resurfaces, kicks the shit out of everybody, and now the caliphate begins to stand up again? Will we go back, yes or no? Jeff?
Maybe the situation will be that we need to. Just because we left doesn't mean we can't go back if we have to.
Okay.
And it might be that ISIS doesn't manifest itself that big in Iraq. Although it's perfect because you get that big Sunni area there, you know. Although now that's covered with Shia militia groups, by the way.
Right.
Because they don't want, the Iraqis don't want that shit to happen again. So especially the Shia Iraqis. And, you know, so.
But wasn't that the problem last time? Wasn't there Shia units out there and they said, fuck it, we ain't dying for this?
No. No.
Those were all Sunni units?
That was the regular army, yeah. And because of us, it was pretty well integrated by that time.
Right.
They just didn't see, they didn't want to fight for Anbar province.
Right.
The U.S. trained Iraqi army didn't give two shits about Anbar province. And neither did the Anbars. They're like, yeah, we'll try these ISIS guys for a while. Then, holy shit, they're throwing people off the tops of buildings. They're worse than Zarqawi was, if that can be believed. Of course, that's what they were. They're descendants of Zarqawi.
Right.
You know, they're descendants of that strain of Islamic fundamentalism that Al-Qaeda pushed out there. I mean, this guy, Zarqawi, he's the same level as ISIS. And he was even chastised by Zawahiri for being too brutal. This is the guy who is like cheering as people are on fire, jumping out of the World Trade Center and stuff. He's saying that this guy, Zarqawi, is being too brutal. And Baghdadi's just the understudy of, or was just the understudy of, you know, Zarqawi. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think Trump just did this. Okay, what are our vital interests? And I see guys like Dr. Gorka and all these other guys giving them the basic class. I explain to me now, after all this, you guys gave me the 101, geopolitics 101, how is this in our interest? Go. National prestige. And blah, blah, blah. Here's a guy named Trump who had his penis size disguised or described by one of his ex-wives. He's probably thinking prestige over money and blood. It's not getting it for me, you know?
Yeah, but, you know, you discount the whole, you said the ship has sailed when it comes to Iran, right? Iran's already taken over everything from Iraq to the Med?
No, I didn't mean that. I mean the Assad government is wholly, pretty much in the pocket of the Iranians. Yeah.
All right, Timmy.
Yeah, no, that's and therein lies some good news, because, you know, as Jeff is saying, it's hard to discern to discern where our interests lie, particularly given our energy independence these days. And our role as the hegemon. We don't want to, obviously, to see chaos and disorder breaking out in massive areas. But now we've got, for whatever reasons, how we got here, we've got Turkey in the northern Syria. Syria's fighting Turkey. The guys fighting Turkey and Syria are fighting both of them and each other. And you've got Iranians. The Iranians have flexed as much muscle as they can into the Bekaa Valley into Lebanon and clearly established a nice fertile crescent of Shia influence. That's war for the next 300 years, my friends. And we don't have to be a part of it. But it's going to be there.
It's worse than Lebanon was in the 80s, man.
Wait a minute. I mean, we don't have to be there. Israel's there. I mean, so...
Oh, no. I don't think the Israelis... Dude, I don't think the Israelis are going to be taking a lot of gruff from these guys. They're going to have enough... For one thing, the Shias and the Sunnis are going to have enough on their hands just with each other. But I don't know how many people want to tickle Israel, because Israel tends to hurt you when they respond. They don't fool
a lot around. Of that stuff, a lot of that hardware the Kurds are using comes from Israel.
You know, I read
so an they're there. I mean, they're not there like, you know, like stupidly like we would be. You actually have guys there. But they're supporting, you know, certain groups of Kurds.
There's an article, I think it's in Wall Street Journal, Iran opens a second front along Israel's border. And it talked about the last time the Israelis went north, they ran into the cave system of Iwo Jima, and it was tough slugging for them. And that is now being a second part of it is being installed on the Syrian side of the Golan. And so it's a pretty interesting little article talking about the Iranian in this what it contends is the Iranian hemming in of Israel. Then with rockets and putting Israel in this anyway in this thing. So pretty interesting little article. All right, any stray rounds now that we've completely not solved any of that? Jeff would just walk away. I would as the president, I would say, okay, here's what we're gonna do. I'm going to tell them we're going to be gone in 12 months. All right. I will go to the UN with the American hat in the American hand and say, look, we've done our best. With all the best intentions, we cannot contain this any longer. And so we're going to leave, and we believe there ought to be, we'll do our best to broker an arrangement, but we believe there ought to be forces between these two peoples, and they ought to be United Nations forces. And knowing full good and well that they're going to say not only no, but fuck no, right? And when they say fuck no, then I'll hold another press availability on the, right, as I head out to Marine One and say, you know, I find that truly regrettable because these scumbags are going to cause a human catastrophe of great proportions that we do not want to see, which is why I went to them. So that blood is on their hands. Now, I would say that because I'm a shitbag politician, knowing full good and well that I'm the one that's ultimately, or my predecessor is ultimately the one, and his asshole, you know, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and other people that are Secretary of Defense, Rumsfeld, right, and all those shitbags that advised him along the road to go do these stupid things. But nonetheless, you know, and so to me, that's I would say that in terms of managing Trump's decision, right, you've done is you've walked the dog, you know, politically, you've walked the dog, you've given, you know, your military notice that we're leaving, you know, do the best you can, tie this shit up, blah, 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 blah.
We'll still help you, but we're not good, yeah, right.
Right, and so, yeah, so, anyway. Timmy, any say grounds?
I like the thought of putting pressure on the UN, because that's another way of putting pressure, particularly on our European allies, to spend on their defense somewhere close to what we spend on our defense, because Jeff is right about these humanitarian crises that pop up, and as we've discussed in the past, really we're the only military that can send large flat tops to do an evacuation in the event of a natural crisis. I know the Chinese have done a couple. I found out in 2017 and 2015 of their people in the Indian Ocean region. But they're only using frigates, and we're not limited to needing dockage or that kind of stuff. But I like the idea of putting more responsibility on the UN. But I know that they're going to fail, And that's the problem is, as much as I like the thought of saying, hey, look, we're not the hegemon. You guys are always complaining about us throwing our weight around. Here's your chance to help out, too. We're going to need some help with this. We're
because what they're going to do is...
I like that.
The pushback you're going to get as we war game this thing, okay, we say this, and then what do they say? Right? Well, what they're going to say is, you can't leave like that. Right? If you leave in 12 months, you are going to cause a human... you know, catastrophe of proportions that we think you're underestimating. And that's when I, as the president, look at him and say, that's why I'm here at the United Nations. We need you, if you're that concerned, we need you now, right, to be part of this UN force that goes in there and gets between this thing. And I completely understand your sentiment, right? And I believe you're right. And I want to offer you the opportunity to keep that from happening. So thank you, Mr. Macron, right? Good luck. Good luck there, motherfucker.
And yeah, no kidding. Right?
So, anyway. No, it's just, you know, it's just, I don't know. You watch it. It's just frustrating. All right, boys. Thank you very much for the visit. Have a great rest of the week and have a great weekend. And we'll solve another problem on the next episode of The Lynch and Kenny Event right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.